Morning, friends. I'm reading from Genesis chapter 32, which is on page 45 in the Hebrew Bible section of the Pew Bible. And I'm going to read not the whole chapter, but verses 22 to 32. Genesis chapter 32, verses 22 to 32. Before I start, I've got to make one note here to remind myself of something, so bear with me. I'm not going to be able to find it. All right, well. Genesis chapter 32, beginning at verse 22. The same night he, that being Jacob, the same night he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And then he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the thigh muscle that is on the hip socket, because he struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle. All right, so we'll let, I guess Dharma is taking Cassidy and Harper and maybe Sebastian downstairs. Well, the story of Jacob has moved on quite a bit since the first little bit that we looked at last week. Since Bethel, a lot has happened. He has spent years in Laban's house, the house of the man who becomes his father-in-law and who is his father's kinsman. He has acquired wives and children and servants and flocks and herds. And if you remember, when he leaves home, and he spends that first night at Bethel where he sees the vision of the angels descending, ascending and descending on the ladder. He has nothing. He doesn't even have a sack that he can put under his head, so he sleeps on a stone. But in Bethel, he prospers by cleverness and trickiness in part, but also through hard work. And so he comes back with all of this stuff. God tells him to return to his homeland, and so he has to pack up all his stuff, which is something that I sympathize with intimately right now. And I know Stephanie feels it even more intimately than I do. Moving is really terrible. And most of you know this. But having to put everything in a box or get rid of it one way or the other, well, for one thing, it makes you appreciate how much ideally we really don't need, how defined our lives are by stuff, and how little of that we really need. But you know, if you're sitting in one place and you gradually acquire stuff, you know, what I need is, I need like something on my credit card whenever I buy a book to, you know, on the cash register window or something, flash up a warning saying, "This book weighs X number of ounces. Think about that in you know, cumulative weight with all the other books that you own." So, Jacob gets past all that. He has servants to help him with stuff like this, right? So he packs up everything he owns and he returns from Laban's land after having been there for many years. But remember where he's returning to. He's returning to the land of his father and mother. He's returning to the land of Isaac and Rachel, or Isaac and Rebecca, sorry. But he's also returning, that means, to the land of his brother Esau, the one whom he supplanted and betrayed in the first part of his life story. And he comes here to the ford of the Jabbok. Bethel, with its vision of the ladder to the heavens, was the emblem of the beginning of his exile, and the ford of the Jabbok is the emblem of its end. They're the sort of mystical bookends to this time that he spends in Laban's land. And now he's returning to the land of his father and the land of his brother. We didn't read the first part of chapter 32. It's a fairly long chapter, and there's a lot of detail, but I just want to reprise a little bit of what happens. Jacob anticipates that there's going to be trouble with Esau because he's mistreated him in a number of ways. So he sends messengers ahead to say, your brother Jacob is returning. And they come back and they say, oh, Esau is waiting with 400 men. And that's probably not good, right? So Jacob prays, asking God for protection and coincidentally reminding God of the promises that God has made to him. You know, God, I'm going back to this land like you said, and you promised that it would go well for me, right? Don't forget that. And he devises this elaborate plan to appease Esau. He divides up his herds, hundreds of goats and sheep and donkeys and camels, and he spaces each group out from the one that goes before it. So he sends off one group first and then sends off the next after a little bit. And so they're going on their way towards Esau's territory, and each of them is to be a gift for Esau, but they're not all bunched up. Each herder is to tell Esau, these are a gift from your brother Jacob. He's coming along behind us, but these are for you. Which on the one hand makes for a dramatic and impressive entrance. You know, oh, not just this herd, but the one behind it and the one behind that. But it also protects each one. If some of Esau's 400 men attack the first group, then the others can turn tail and flee. So as always, Jacob is a clever conniver. Then, after having seen to his wife and children, he brings them across the river. He finds himself alone by the river Jabbok, much as he did at Bethel years and years previously. He finds himself alone. And then a man wrestles with him until daybreak. This is perhaps one of the most debated questions in biblical interpretation. Who is this mysterious assailant? Who is this man? It could just be a man. But why not identify him then, if it is a man? The word that is used there is simply, at the beginning, man, but then later it says that Jacob struggled with God, and he himself says that he has seen God face to face. This word for man is often used in the Hebrew Bible to refer to angels, messengers from God who appear in human form. And one of the most important places, one of the most significant places, is in Genesis chapter 18 and 19. Three men, you'll remember, appear to Abraham. And Abraham and Sarah provide them with hospitality, and then they discuss with Abraham the fate of Sodom. And there's this strange point in the text where there were three men, and then all of a sudden there's just the Lord. And then later on in the story, it's three men again. So there's some ambiguity to the way that this word man is used in the Hebrew Bible. Sometimes it refers to people, to male, you know, adult males, adult male humans. Sometimes it refers to angels. Sometimes it seems to refer to the presence of God, God's self. So is this God that Jacob is wrestling with? Is it an angel? Is it someone else? Perhaps it's Esau in disguise. That's one possible interpretation. Quite a few ways to understand this. And let me say to start that I don't know for certain which the best one is. Each has its merits, and I think part of the reason that this text is so rich is precisely because of the ambiguity, precisely because it's difficult to say for certain who Jacob's assailant is and why they are wrestling all night there by the ford of the Jabbok. Now, if it's God, what does it mean for Jacob to have struggled with God and prevailed? First of all, can we conceive of a God who would wrestle on equal terms with a human all night long? What does that tell us about God? And then Walter Brueggemann, of course, points out that the converse is also an interesting question. What does this tell us about Jacob? What kind of superhero would be able to fight the Creator to a draw? This is not something that we see in biblical narrative very often. And it's made a lot of people uncomfortable over the years. God is supposed to be powerful, right? God is supposed to be the all-powerful Creator. Why would he want to wrestle with somebody all night long? Excuse me. And as I have been doing, you know, often when I speak this kind of a message about one of the patriarchs, one of the great cloud of witnesses in the biblical witness, we're looking for some kind of model, right? We're looking for their behavior as a model for us. But Jacob is one of those ones who's, a lot of his behavior is really more, let's learn about this and not do what he did, right? So I don't mean to present Jacob without some reflection. I don't mean to present Jacob here as a model for our behavior necessarily in anything that he does, really. But here in particular, although we will come back to that question, is Jacob's behavior a model for us in any way? And part of why I like to look at these patriarchal characters in the Bible in the sort of primal narrative of the middle part of the book of Genesis is because of what their faith, because we see in them examples of people who trusted in God and yet were completely, perfectly flawed. Wait a minute, that's kind of an oxymoron. Who were completely flawed in all sorts of human ways and yet trusted in God. That's what I mean to say. But if Jacob's behavior here by the ford of the Jabbok is a model for us in some ways, what does that tell us about trust? How do we trust someone with whom we struggle? How do we trust our opponent in a wrestling match? Is God someone who will allow us to struggle and yet remain in a trusting relationship with God? There are a couple of other important things about this. There are lots of other important things about this story, but a couple that I want to point out. First of all, the context of this story is really important, which is part of why I reminded you of the first part of chapter 32. This is an interlude in the Jacob-Esau story. In fact, it might seem to sort of stick out like a sore thumb because it doesn't seem to have anything to do with their story. Just before this passage, remember, as I just said, there's this elaborate plan to impress and appease Esau that Jacob hatches and executes. And just following, he finds that none of that was really necessary. Esau welcomes him back with a tearful embrace, as if Jacob had never done him wrong. All of Jacob's thievery, conniving, and betrayal has, it seems, been forgotten. And so this story of wrestling is inserted in the middle of Jacob's frantic conniving to come up with a plan that's going to fix things with his brother, and his discovering that he didn't have to do that, and his brother's loving acceptance of him on his return. It reminds me of nothing so much as the story of what's often called the prodigal son in the Gospel of Luke, but is perhaps more accurately thought of as the loving father. Because Esau's reaction to Jacob is just like the reaction of that father when he sees his beloved son returning. So in the midst of this story of reconciliation between brothers, of unexpected reconciliation, of a plan to appease the other not being necessary because the other has already forgiven, comes this contest between Jacob and the angel, or God, God's self, or someone else. But one of the interpretations that is possible of what the wrestling of who Jacob's opponent is that it's Esau, or that it is in some way a spiritual or angelic representative of Esau, and that the struggle that they have there all night on the ford of the Jabbok is all that is necessary for their reconciliation. So that's another possibility that fits this story into its context. One of the other really important things about this story is the transformation that Jacob undergoes in the midst of this wrestling match. His name is changed, just as the name of his grandfather Abraham was changed from Abram to Abraham by God. Jacob's name is changed here from Yaakov, which has a variety of meanings associated with it. But if you remember the story of when he's born, he comes out right after Esau, and he's got Esau's heel in his hand. Part of the word Yaakov elicits this heel grabbing, this pulling back, this grasping after everything that you can get. So he goes from that grasping person, the striver, the conniver, to Israel. Now, unfortunately, the etymology of Israel is kind of obscure. And the simplest explanation is the one that the story gives, that it means he strove with God, or he struggled with God. But grammatically, that doesn't really make any sense. In Hebrew grammar, as I understand it, it's really more like God struggles or God strove. So others have suggested a variety of other meanings for this name. But the active agent in Israel is, by the grammar, God rather than Jacob or any person. So it could also mean God preserves or God protects. There are lots of possibilities and many competing understandings of what that word means. But in this name change, just the way that Abram's name was changed, he is identified as the father of the nation, his sons as the progenitors of the 12 tribes, or will be 12, 12 sons and 12 tribes. God's future for God's people established. Remember the promise made to Abram and Sarai of descendants as numerous as the sand on the seashore is here realized in this name transformation. Pardon me, he's going home with a new name. He's returning to the home of his father with a new identity. Perhaps leaving the striving and the conniving behind. So it's not just a change of name, it's also a transformation of character. Although some would point out that just in the next chapter, Jacob makes excuses not to go to Seir with his brother. You get the sense he's still a little nervous about Esau, and so he may be going back to his deceptive ways. So a more thorough review of Jacob's subsequent history is warranted. Is this as thorough a personal transformation here as some interpreters say that it is? So this is a story of transformation, even in the midst of a lot of ambiguity. The transformation is clear. I think that we can also interpret this story psychologically or perhaps allegorically, if you will. From one perspective, Jacob's struggle on the banks of the Jabbok is a struggle with himself. His assailant may be himself. And the struggle may be with his former nature, his past, the old way of doing things, all of that striving and conniving. And the blessing that he needs out of that is the death of those ways. That those old choices have come to an end. So perhaps he is struggling with himself there in this wrestling, in this story of wrestling. One way that I think, returning to this question of trust and what it means to trust someone with whom we struggle, I think we can see this struggle that Jacob makes as a struggle that involves trust. And part of the reason I say that is that Jacob doesn't, when he has struggled with God and prevailed, he doesn't do a victory lap. He doesn't do an end zone dance or whatever its, you know, patriarchal Hebrew narrative equivalent would be. Instead of taking the land or the wives or the riches of the person over whom he has prevailed, he asks for a blessing, and he holds on, even though his hip has been put out of joint, he holds on to his opponent until he gets a blessing. And you can't ask for a blessing for someone without expecting that that blessing is good, without trusting that their blessing is worth something. So that's what I mean by struggle with trust. He's in this struggle, but it's not simply about victory. This wrestling match is not just about winning over the other one. It's about coming to a point of blessing, coming to a point of transformation in the midst of that struggle. And so I don't think that you can enter into that kind of a wrestling match without trusting the one with whom you're wrestling. There's one other interpretation or kind of, there's one other way that we can use this story as a metaphor that I think is interesting and that has been useful to me in the past, which comes from the radical theologian and writer and activist Walter Wink. Some of you have read some of Walter Wink's books. And Walter Wink, in the second half of his life, did a lot of seminars and workshops on re-engaging people, especially from the kind of mainline church, people who were maybe a little skeptical of the Bible. He did a lot of work to re-engage people with the scriptures. And Walter Wink encouraged people to use this story of Jacob wrestling with the assailant, whoever it is, as a way of understanding how we can relate to the difficult parts of Scripture. Those passages that just seem to be about terrible stuff, and you can't figure out where God is, and you can't figure out why God would want any of this stuff to happen. And you can't, it just, you can't make heads nor tails of it. And you'd rather just not read that part of the Bible. You all know parts of the Bible. You probably have your own personal ones that you would prefer not to read. Walter Wink's suggestion was that we relate to those passages as Jacob relates to this mysterious wrestling man here. You struggle with it until it gives you a blessing. You enter into the struggle with trust that God yet has something in this that can be a blessing to you. Now, some of that struggle takes an awful long time. Some of that is a lifelong struggle. But I think it's a really useful way for us to understand how we can continue to engage with the scriptures as if it were, as if they were a mysterious man who wrestles with us in the nighttime. Finally, I think something that we can all take away from this story is that the life of the Spirit involves struggle. This is not something that I need to tell any of you, for you all have your own struggles. And you know that anything worth doing in this life involves struggle, or at least effort. Sometimes we hear a narrative of Christian experience that makes it sound like once we have begun to follow Jesus, once we have made that decision and have stepped over the threshold into the reign of God, everything thereafter is sunshine and rainbows and happiness. And again, you know that this is not true, but there's a lot of that narrative out there. The life of the Spirit is a struggle against self and sin, against despair in difficult circumstances, against dryness and doubt sometimes. And at times our struggle is even against God. Perhaps our most intense struggles are against God when we feel that we have been abandoned by all that we hold dear and everyone we love. When we just can't make sense of things that have happened in our lives or the lives of those that we love. when we see terrible injustices visited upon innocent people, some of whom we don't even know. Sometimes that struggle is against God, sometimes it is against ourselves. But regardless of the particular nature of the struggle, if we are walking in the path that Jesus laid out for us when he was praying so fervently in the Garden of Gethsemane that his sweat became like blood, when his struggle was that intense, remember that our struggle is a struggle in trust, that our struggle is a struggle that yet has in it a blessing if we will faithfully continue to engage in that struggle and trust that God is there in that struggle, whether God is struggling alongside us or whether we are struggling ourselves with God.